Some people have been asking me over the past couple of weeks, Jimmy, what's the next episode? And every time I've said something like, I just interviewed John Norton. He's the executive director at NYSEF, which is the ski program in Lake Placid. He's run a lot of NORAM races and the World University Games a couple of years ago. And I interviewed him about how races are run. And the response I get to this is sometimes a blank stare back at me, kind of like, why didn't I interview another big time World Cup winner? So then I explain that we, all ski racers, have been enjoying the hard work of everyone and everything that contributes to putting on a ski race. And yet we don't really know any of the details. I mean, the other day I asked three different World Cup skiers what kinds of officials are on the jury, and I got three wrong answers. So let's do this thing. And we are back. I'm Jimmy Krupka, and welcome to Arc City. Arc City is officially sponsored by Ski Racing Media. This episode is sponsored by On Location. I'd also like to thank Sync Performance for supporting me this season, and a shout out to Ski Cosmos, a ski simulator and training center in Vancouver. Learn more at skicosmos.com. Now, I actually had a lot of fun talking about running races, and was way more interesting than I thought it would be. So I think you'll really enjoy this one. Without further ado, John Norton. John Norton, welcome to Arc City.
Awesome. Thanks for having me, Jimmy.
I'm excited about this conversation, and I was just telling you before we started recording, so many kids that ski race, and adults, men, women who ski race, don't know what goes into running a race and every little detail. Some people don't know what the jury is, don't know all the different officials, don't know all of this work that goes into running races for people. And a lot of it is through like a love of the sport. Anyway, I'm getting ahead of myself, but to start off, can you just tell me like the officials who are responsible for helping a race happen, and then we'll kind of move from there?
Sure, be happy to. Yeah, and just so for those that don't know me, I'm the director here at NYSEF at Whiteface.
Yes, sorry, I didn't give you an introduction.
Oh, no problem. No. I'm the director at NYSEF, the New York Ski Educational Foundation, where we primarily host races at Whiteface, but NYSEF oversees the Alpine venues at Gore and Bel Air as well, New York State run venues. So we put on a lot of races. We put on a lot of big races, a lot of regional races, a lot of smaller club races. And it's one of the things.
And NORAMs too.
And NORAMs, sure. Yeah. And I think we do a solid job and we enjoy doing it. And I think, it does take, to your point, it takes so many different people, so many different aspects can go right or go wrong on a race day to make a great experience for the athletes. So, but to dive right into your point about, you know, who's who on a race day, the official roles of the jury, are the technical delegate, the chief of race, and the ref. So we'll start with the TD. They're sort of in charge of the whole program. They ensure that the rules are followed. The event runs smoothly. They're largely the stopgate to make sure everything works. So they're the one in charge of the whole thing. They're assigned by the NGB or the national governing body. In our case, that's US Ski and Snowboard typically.
So US Ski and Snowboard will basically say, so these races are scheduled and they will say, okay, we've got someone who's, gone through the qualification process. They are a TD and they're going to be the TD at this race. They get assigned to a race and that's how it goes.
You got it. And that person, he or she is the chair of the jury, which, you know, so they oversee technically the chief of race, who is appointed by the local organizing committee. And the chief of race is typically directs all preparation and supervises everything, all the positions from the organizing committee, which is the volunteers and the hill prep and everything that goes into running the race from the venue. Here at Whiteface, that's typically Paul Van Slyke or myself, depending on the event. And then the ref or the assistant ref is typically from amongst the coaches that come at a regional FIS race. At a NORAM or a higher level, that might be appointed by the NGB, and that might be Tom Johnson or Trevor Wagner or someone like that, that oversees, they're the technical advisor, but they also serve as a member of the jury.
And so the ref race, at low level FIS race, would it just be kind of one of the coaches?
Generally. Yep. Yeah. Generally it might be somebody that the TD appoints that person. That person might be, a veteran coach. And it also might be somebody that's learning to come along in a speed race. That might be typically somebody who they pair somebody that has been around the block, and then somebody that's, you know, new and, you know, developing their officials history, and trying to gain some experience. But those folks are the people that make up the jury.
Gotcha.
The referee handles all the faults, or the, you know, counts the gatekeeper cards. We'll get into that a little bit. Okay. In a second, but they're responsible for helping the jury oversee the rules and sort of advocating for the athlete experience.
Gotcha.
Right.
So we've got our three of the jury, the TD, the chief of race, and the ref.
You got it. Yep. Mm-hmm. And again, in cases of a speed event, there's an assistant ref. Now, the course setter, of course, is not a member of the jury, but they're appointed by the jury. They're the person that goes up and, you know, places the gates with help of course crew. There's a jury advisors. There are assistants to the jury with a start ref and a finish ref. So at races, you know, you may have seen somebody at the organizing things at the start and sort of supervising that. And same thing at the finish, somebody managing the finish line or finish corral and talking to the forerunners as they come through. Those folks are not, they're advisors to the jury, but they're not voting members, but they're crucial parts. And then there's folks, you know, the chief of course sort of oversees all the race crew and all the volunteers that help managing the surface or the B net or the gates, and the panels. So those are sort of the key roles.
So the chief of course is not on the jury, but it's somebody who's in charge of making sure there's safety on the hill, B nets, the snow has been prepped well, all that.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. But you know, to your point about the volunteers, there's anywhere from 6 to 10 gatekeepers on the hill that are making sure that athletes pass the right side of the gate. There's hand timers at the start and finish for backup timing, you know, because that does happen. We'll have an athlete take out the finish, or simply a mechanical failure that, you know, we miss an impulse. And so we sometimes use a hand timer to verify times or to get that missed time.
Oh, let's pause with the hand timing for a second. Have you ever had a race, like an important racer in a race, decided by hand timing?
Yeah. I can say that we had one at NCAAs just 2 years ago.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Unfortunately, one of our other athletes was slipping and just didn't pay attention to where they were going, and managed to just slide right into the finish stake and the finish. The timing eyes. And they had just started bib. I don't know. That was, you know, this athlete was watching bib 9 of the first run, and then bib 10 had just left the gate. And there, this athlete is flopping down over the finish line. It was a woman, and she was completely embarrassed. And, you know, that stuff happens. But yeah, all of a sudden we're scrambling to make sure that hand timer at the finish got an impulse. And we had to do what they call an EET, which is an estimation of, you know, based on the variance that comparing the previous athlete's variance from the hand timing to the actual timing system, and they apply a correction. So it's all part of the rules.
Oh,
we got all the data we needed, and we did an EET, and that athlete got a time per the rules. But yeah, so, it's a little bit nerve wracking.
Yeah, that is. So just for people who don't know, like, how the hand timing works, and let me know if I describe this correctly. I think there's a person at the start gate with a hand timer, and there's a person at the finish, and they try to click the button right when the wand opens, and the finish person tries to click the button right when the person crosses the finish line. And those timers have been synced, right? So that they're exactly the same time to the hundredth.
You got it. A lot of people think it's an elapsed time, but it's actually time of day. So all the timing equipment on the hill is synced to the exact time of day And therefore, when that person leaves the Stargate or crosses the finish line, an actual time of day to the thousandth or 10,000th precision is taken. And the difference in those times is the athlete's time. So when everything's working correctly, that's a hardwired connection from the start block to the timing system in the finish building, right? So the computer, the timer's receiving that data, you know, that time of day, you know, if it's at 9 o'clock, it's hour 9:31 and 10,000th of a second, right? And then it's computing the difference of those times. It's not just like, okay, it starts a watch at the top and then it finishes at the bottom. So in theory, and in actual, you would be surprised. You'd be shocked at how close the hand times are.
Really?
It's really, once you start to do some of the calculations, you're like, wow. And any athlete I would put it in there that's questioning a hand time, I think they are within, I don't even know. They're
within
they're,
a tenth of a right second.
It closer than that.
Really? Okay. Typically. Wow. Yeah. So when you have to use a hand time because the other timer broke, do you get that time from the previous racer and you look at the difference between the real time and the hand time, and then you apply that to
a correction.
Okay. Gotcha.
Yeah, and that it's the previous 10 racers.
Oh, previous 10 racers. So it's an average.
It's an average of the previous 10 racers.
Gotcha. So the closest 10 racers typically.
So if you're in the beginning of it, you might have to use a couple that are after. But generally speaking, it happens middle of the run, and you have 10 times in the before it that you can use as your
gotcha. Okay.
Correction. Yeah.
Okay. That's really cool.
Yeah, it doesn't happen. It probably happens at Whiteface. We probably put on upwards of 40 races a year, and it might happen twice a year.
Okay. So it's very, very rare. Yeah.
But once
the timer breaks, you don't keep running the race on hand timing. You wait until you fix the timing, right?
You got it.
Yeah.
Yeah. You got it. Typically the things that happen are somebody crashes through the finish and finished and equipment's flying all over the place, or, We've had one of them we had to do. The athlete was a small and there was a little dip in the finish. It teaches the timer to make sure that your finish eyes are at the right, at a nice level spot, because this little girl, it was like a U14 race and she was tiny. She tucked and she was like a little, and she got under the finish.
Underneath the eyes.
the hill had a concave spot to it. And we couldn't figure out because everything tested out, and that's the only thing that could have happened. So stuff like that happens. Or if you fall on the finish, we've seen athletes slide underneath the finish eyes that way, same way, you know?
Yeah.
So those are the things that fluke things, but they happen.
Yeah.
There's tons of redundancy built into doing a sanctioned event.
Yeah. And the other thing you mentioned about times is that they go to the thousandths or 10,000ths of a second.
Yeah,
but the rule is you only show the results with the hundredths, which means that for every tie that has ever happened, we could know who beat the other person.
That's a good point. I've not been part of many discussions about you know, changing that, but yeah, potentially.
Like for instance, Andrew Weibrecht, actually a Lake Placid native, he tied with Bodie Miller for the bronze medal at the 2014 Olympics. Is that right?
No, I think he got the silver in 2014 and maybe Bodie got the gold. I don't remember. I'd have to look it up myself.
I have to look it up. But I know there was a tie one year at the Olympics, and so like maybe one person wouldn't have gotten that medal if they did timing to the thousandth of a second.
I am not the timing expert in the room. But you could, I'm sure there's an argument to be made for that. Sure.
Interesting. Huh. It would just be cool. Like, where do they keep that that information? You know, is that in the timing hut? But then once the race is over, it's gone, or?
Well, all that stuff is stored in the timer and it ends up in the software as a, you know, actually you can see all that data in the software, but it's, you know, push to the hundredth.
Oh, okay, gotcha. So you'd have to look into the software if you wanted to see it. It's not just right, kind of right there. It's not easy to see. Gotcha. Oh, I just looked this up. Oh, yeah. Weibrecht took the silver, and Jan Hudek and Bode tied for the bronze in 2014.
Is that what it was? Yeah.
Okay. So
I did know Weibrecht got the silver in 2014, but I could not remember the rest of the podium. Good point.
Yeah. Oh, good. So we took a little detour there, but the other detour I wanted to take before we keep going is you mentioned the assigning of course setters, and like, you know, on the World Cup, this is a big deal because it's high stakes. But even I've been to some NORAMs and even some lower level FIS races where there's that one coach who has a reputation for crazy courses. How does the assignment of the course setter work? And is it kind of like a buddy-buddy thing? Oh, that's my friend who's a coach and I'm the ref. I'll just assign him the course set. Or how does that work?
Well, I'm not as familiar with how it happens at the World Cup, but I do know, you know, for some of the larger events, Olympics, maybe World Champs, and maybe some of the World Cup, the FIS Council assigns them, or there's some sort of rotation through the nations. Generally speaking, at a regional FIS race, the TD will, the TD and the organizing committee will appoint, so to speak. The TD is responsible for appointing the course setter, but that might be a TD may have some ideas. If it's a tricky or particularly challenging environment to set in, they may look for someone more experienced. If it's less tricky or we're looking for someone to gain some experience, they may take volunteers at the team captain's meeting, which typically happens the night before the race. If it's a 4-day series, you know, as an organizer, sometimes the TD will ask me or Paul who they think would be good course setter, who knows the hill, right? Who's going to have a good chance at having a fair course set. And we might say, we might look at over a 4-day series. I always try to look for, you know, spread around the East, right? Somebody from Vermont, somebody from New Hampshire, somebody from Maine. Doesn't always work that way. And you sort of have to, you know, sometimes it depends on who can get there early, right? We head up in a snowcat or a gondola at 7 a.m. And unfortunately, some of the coaches need to go take care of their athletes in the morning. And, you know, otherwise the kids are sitting around in the base lodge for an extra hour. So it's a little bit of give and take. And it depends on the situation, depends on the field, depends on the clubs that are here. But yeah, I don't. That's generally how it works, if that answers your question.
Yeah, yeah. No, it does. Yeah. It's interesting how much leeway there is, how much play there is in terms of the assignments. You know, there's not like a strict rule or structure for it, but it makes sense because you want to be able to choose someone that you know has experience. And if there was some sort of strict rule structure, it might get...
No, I should add that at a NORAM, there's a rotation between U.S. and Canada.
So, yeah, that's right. Yeah,
It's not, I am not involved with that. And that typically is predetermined by the NORAM committee or someone that works with both nations. But that is something that there's generally some level of equity that they try to, that we all try to strive for. It's just all those factors, somebody's sick or we had this person assigned and they didn't end up coming to the series or whatever it is, and there might need to be last minute changes.
Yeah. And I do know that there is like a much more structure on the World Cup. And for those listeners who don't know, like the World Cup speed events, a lot of them, they put the gates in the exact same spot. They use a GPS to make sure the gates are literally in the exact same spot. And sometimes they'll move it a bit, but
that's definitely true for downhill. I don't know that that's true.
No, just downhill. Downhill.
It's not down. It's not true for Super G typically. Mm-hmm. I don't think ever, probably. But
no.
Downhill is very much set to the hill. I mean, that's
why you can have like a course record on Kitzbühel, even though it's completely irrelevant because it depends on snow and terrain and all that.
It would not be uncommon for the cheaper race or the cheaper course or somebody very local to have a very active hand in setting that downhill, making sure it's where it was in the past.
I've got a discount code for you for Sync Performance. And I love Sync not only because they make great products like my snow pants that have the perfect size and placement of pockets and they're waterproof and the side zippers never break. I could go on and on, because Sync is improving their designs every year because they get feedback from their ski racing athletes. I literally sit on Zoom and tell them what to change. It's awesome. But also I love Sync because they have always supported independent ski racers like me. And through the Sync Athlete Fund, they help bridge the funding gap in ski racing from U16s all the way to senior racers. You can shop all the great skiing and ski racing products that Sync has to offer at syncperformance.com and use the code ARCCITY15 for 15% off your order. All right, well, let's dive back into the officials. We sure. Went through the jury.
We talked about the jury. Yeah, we talked about the jury advisors, but the gatekeepers, we have we talked about hand timers, right? That's where we got sidetracked. Mm-hmm. But at a typical series here, we might have as few as 6 or 8 course crew that are helping. We might have at a bigger event, we might have as many as 25, 30 course crew that are working different sections of the event or have different levels of responsibilities, managing slippers, checkpoints, you know, stationed in one spot, running rakes or shovels. We usually, how I like to manage it is I have a handful of people with eyes on the hill everywhere and support if there's an immediate issue, athlete goes down, panel comes off a gate, you know, they can get there pretty quickly. And then I have what I call fire crew, you know, to put out fires at the start. So we can dispatch them with a spare gate or a drill or helping an athlete out of the B net. And we sort of stage them in different spots along the course. At our hill, we have a, you know, someone at the start and then someone at at the mid station on the lift. So they can loop mm-hmm. on the lower section and the upper fire crew loops up in the upper section. I think it really depends on the event, how many we have, and other venues manage it the same way. Other venues manager, you know, they manage it a little bit differently. And so I think depends on who you have, who your strengths mm-hmm. are. But it takes a lot of people and, you know, a lot of help on the hill.
Yeah. I was going to say like, that's something that can totally make or break if you get a race off on time is people helping on the hill, like broken gates, especially in slalom and then flags coming off in GS, Super G, whatever. Yep. I've had races that have tiny race crews and the races get delayed for an hour, 2 hours because there's constantly holds because the gates are constantly out and there's just not enough people on the hill. Typically, I know I've raced NORAMs at Copper and they have like a competition crew that is paid yearly to put on competitions. But at like Whiteface, do you have people who are paid or is this all volunteer work?
We have a mix. And I think some clubs at the smallest level are all volunteer and some are professional like Copper, right? I think we have a mix of folks that come in on a per day basis and we pay them part time. We have some people that volunteer and just want to be out there, you know, watching their kid or, you know, this is just, they love ski racing. So we're fortunate enough to have a good group of folks that, you know, do it for various reasons, but they're all super competent and they're passionate about making sure there's a fair race on the hill for the kids.
Yeah. And they also have to make sure that you have to make sure they're competent because time I came over a roll one time and somebody was still fixing the gate, you know, and everyone had been screaming course. You ever have those people that are just clueless and they end up in the course?
We've had newbies, right? That, that cut their teeth and they're rookie move. Right. And we've had, we have veterans that make the mistake. So there's a lot of variables. There's a lot of things happening out there. The start intervals, which, you know, they're fixed for GS, Super G and downhill or variable for slalom. So that they change at times depending on the size and, you know, mistakes happen even from some of our veteran crew and jury members. But yeah, I know what you're saying. It can be frustrating for an athlete that has to go get a rerun or whatever.
Yeah.
But it happens on occasion.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, even at the highest level, I don't know if you saw what happened in Solden. You see this with,
I did.
Yeah. So for those who don't know, Seigo Kato, who's a Japanese GS skier on the World Cup, he was running towards the back and, the head of the Austrian Ski Federation was slipping the course and didn't realize that the race was still running or something like that. And yep. Sago had to stop, obviously, because the guy was in the middle of the track. And he didn't get a rerun.
Oh, I didn't hear that.
He did not get a rerun. And a lot of people were pretty fired up about it, actually.
Okay.
A lot of guys were posting on Instagram, complaining about it. And no, Fist didn't give him a rerun because it was towards the end of first run, and the schedule had been compressed because bib 31 to 41, as opposed to being 45-second intervals or whatever like it normally is, they did the full minute 15 for TV because Hersher's first race back and Broughton's first race back. So the schedule was compressed and they said, sorry, you don't get a rerun, which I'm not going to put my opinion out there of that. But
to your point, you know, or one of our points, you know, that's the head of the Austrian Federation. You'd think that person would be never make a mistake, but it happens. It happens to the best of us. And you go, man, what happened? What an idiot, you know, but.
Yeah, it does. Yeah. So speaking of reruns, actually, what is the process? Who's in charge of deciding whether someone gets a rerun?
That's a great question. Generally speaking, if an athlete is interfered with or whatever, something happens to cause them to ski out that is beyond their control, they should approach the nearest gatekeeper or jury member, you know, and often that's the finish ref, because they're halfway down the course. And by the time they slow down, they just come around to the finish, and the finish ref will advise the jury. And racer number 37 is requesting a rerun. And generally speaking, that athlete will be directed to the start to get a provisional, right? The jury may not have all their facts straight, or, you know, may not be able to get the facts right on the time to say, hey, you get a rerun, or no, you don't. Generally a provisional run is authorized. They get up back around and they get their run. And then the jury meets after the first run together to review whatever evidence the athlete or coach brings forward. You know, a course crew's in the way I don't know. I'm trying to think of what else happens.
If there's like an animal running across the course.
Right. We've seen videos. I'm sure most people have seen the video of the deer running across. Yeah, exactly.
So what about like if there's a gate, what if there's a gate leaning kind of pointed at you and you can't really get around it? Is that allowed for a rerun?
I think in most situations, it's a judgment call based on, you know, an athlete and their safety. If a gate's out, the rule is that the athlete needs to make an attempt to ski the line that
around the hole where the gate was.
Around the hole, right? You know, and
yeah.
Unfortunately, that becomes a little bit subjective, and you know, the jury has to make hard decisions at times based on the evidence that they have. Hopefully, there's video of it so they can see it. Generally, the jury is spread out on the hill so they can see most, if not all. The jury, if it's a longer course, the jury can appoint what they call eyes of the jury, which means somebody that's experienced, you know, or a connection coach or somebody that can not necessarily act on behalf of the jury, but serve in a professional sense and say, this is what I saw. So that's data that a jury can act on and make that decision. And sometimes it can be hard. I'm sat on juries when it's not clear, or the information's incomplete, or the gatekeeper card's not drawn correctly, or whatever it is. But generally, if you're an athlete out there, and it better be very obvious that there's an option, there's a safety issue for yourself, or you were interfered with, and you better immediately stop and find the next jury member or the closest jury member. Because if you keep going and then decide all of a sudden that something happened 10 gates before.
Yeah, you have to decide on the spot. Yeah.
That usually doesn't fly too well with the jury. They're like, well, you skied 10 more gates and then you fell and now you want to rerun, you know? So you gotta be, it's all about being honest and trying to be as fair as possible with all the variables.
Yeah. And then the other thing is if a gate breaks and goes in your track, that's not a valid reason for a rerun, right?
Yeah. It's one of those things that's, it's a judgment call, and you got to use the best, you got to gather the most evidence you can and sort of make the decision in the most fair way.
Yeah. Cool. All right. What's keep it moving. So, oh, actually, when you say the jury decides, that's like three guys vote or three people vote, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Yep. And it's just majority wins.
And you got it. Yeah. Yeah. And there might be a case of a tie with the assistant ref, right? If there's a speed event, there's four people. So, but the jury, oh, okay. I'm sorry, the TD breaks ties if there's a, but usually, you know, usually people are reasonable and, in the lack of evidence, folks usually side with the athlete, right? If there's, you're innocent until proven guilty, so to speak, yep. in these situations. So it's not often that there's a split vote. Usually it's usually like, oh, okay, here's
everyone
the evidence.
Agrees. Yeah, obviously. Yeah. Yeah. Gotcha.
Not always, okay. but typically.
Yeah. 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 Okay. Well, what else do you have for us?
You know, I talked a little bit about we're into the positions. You know, two other key positions that are thankless jobs at times are the chief of timing and the RA, right? The race administrator manages all the entries from the federation, creates the start lists, sends the data to the timer. Sometimes that's the same person, sometimes that's different. You know, here typically, Chris Grant is our race administrator. He'll manage all that data and the entries and send that to our timer. Could be Matt Howard from P1 Timing, or it could be some of our other local folks that time different races. So there's a lot mm-hmm. of those folks do a lot of work getting things set up, and then at the end of the day producing the results and getting a final look at everything. And then the other real key that people don't realize is how much goes into prepping the trail and the mountain ops folks, right? The groomers, how much time they spend on getting a hill ready for racing, the ski patrol that are there, that are at every event there's a medical plan, or generally speaking, you know, patrollers are somewhere accessible if there's an emergency, and those patrollers are standing at the top of the hill for the course of the run for the whole time.
Yeah.
No matter how cold it is or no matter how rainy it is,
there's always patrollers at the top of the run.
Do this stuff. Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's important to be courteous and thankful for any of you athletes out there listening or coaches. You know, it's really important to be courteous, appreciative of everyone's efforts on the hill, and a thank you goes a long way for sure.
Yeah. Because there's no other instance, aside from maybe another type of competition, aside from a ski race, there's no other instance where a ski patroller has to stand outside in the cold in one spot, right? It's just for competitions.
Not typically, no, no.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They normally get to warm up.
They normally
at least.
Get to hang out and wait for and do some and ski and, you know, check on the members of the skiing public. But yeah, that's here. They call it race watch. I don't know what they call it other mm-hmm. other mountains, but they go through a rotation, you know, depending on how cold it is or what it is. And gotcha. I'm not sure, 20 minutes, half hour, uh-huh. you know, rotations through the staff that are there.
Yeah. And that's crucial, especially, you know, we've had kids getting sliced up and sure. badly hurt and, yep. and there truly are life-threatening scenarios on the hill.
Right.
So
it's really important that the organizer is in sync with their patrol and they work together to be ready for whatever that is, whether it's communication or having to stop the bleed kit on the sled or know where the nearest stop the bleed kit is and knowing who's available. Some of our crew are super knowledgeable and experienced and qualified in first aid CPR, wilderness first aid CPR. They're paramedics of some kind. You know, so that's really nice to have.
Yeah, that's cool. Yeah, definitely. I think I cut you off. So what was after patrol?
No, that's pretty much it. I think I covered like the big piece. I mean, I don't know how many people that is, but it's a lot. it's a lot of people that work on the hill, off the hill. You know, of course, there's assistance to the timer inside. There's folks that are handing out bibs in the morning, right? If you're picking up your bib and your lift ticket at the training center here or anywhere else, make sure you thank the people that are doing it because there's a good chance they're volunteers.
Yeah, there's some great volunteers. I remember like seeing the same faces every year at Sugarloaf and sure. Whiteface. You get to know those people.
Sure. It's ingrained in the culture of places like Sugarloaf and here for sure.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the fun thing about the ski racing community is those people that want to be a part of it and they help out in small ways like that. The other thing was gatekeepers, and that's an important role. And I also had some questions about gatekeepers. You ever had gatekeepers that missed the call or something like that or messed it
for
up?
Sure.
Yeah.
For sure. You have people, I mean, not everybody has been watching video like you and I have, you know, when I was, you know, when I was an athlete and then coaching, you know, how many slalom videos have you watched and your eyes trained to see a straddle? Straddles can happen quickly and nobody knows. And especially somebody who's a parent that just wants to help their kid and give back to the club. They're like, what's a straddle? You know, they know they've gone through some minimal training, but they're like, you know, they don't see what we see. And for sure. And that's why we try to have eyes of the jury or jury, you know, covering the entire hill. Doesn't always happen. Your coaches typically have some level of video, but you know, a straddle could happen at the top where the coach is at the bottom of the hill, you know, and you can't be everywhere. And again, if it's not definitive, it's pretty rare that someone will DQ people. It happens, but it's rare. I think that
wrongly DQ someone,
see a straddle, and it's actually a clear passage.
But yeah. Gotcha. Yeah.
It's more often. It seems like they miss a straddle. And
yeah,
some athletes are really good about, you know, as you probably know, you know, there's a major ramification at the World Cup for athletes that straddle and keep going.
Yeah. So, 1,000 Swiss francs.
Yeah. It's tough to implement 1,000 Swiss franc fine for U14, but it's a real thing that we want to make sure that our athletes that are coming up know to, you know, hey, something felt funny. Sometimes things feel funny. You get caught in a shin guard and you keep going. But if you knowingly straddle and keep going, that's not really it's frowned upon pretty heavily by a jury or by a program. Definitely.
So if, you know, the gatekeeper doesn't catch it, but the eyes of the jury or someone on the jury sees a straddle, they can very easily put that on the DQ list, right?
They can you know, record the fault I did write down there's a protest period. So when the referee posts the disqualifications, which is called, you know, they do it on the ref report, that gets posted, and coaches, athletes have 15 minutes to submit a protest or, you know, evidence that they didn't straddle or whatever the fault is, typically didn't hike far enough or interdiction to continue, you know, whatever particular fault it is. And then, you know, if there's a protest, then the jury meets and reviews the evidence, and they may overturn it. They may reinforce it depending on what evidence shows up.
Yeah. I've heard some fun stories about, I won't name names, but, I knew a skier on the World Cup who, you know, after the race had finished, they had, they'd straddled and it was on, one camera, but it wasn't on TV. No one knew it. The skier himself didn't know it, but he kind of got brought into the, like the production, the TV production trailer, shown by the chief of race, like, hey, you straddled, just kind of fun drama like that. But, it's hard. And there's been all sorts of different, stories of straddling or not straddling.
I've also seen it in one instance. I don't remember the exact circumstances, but the next day nobody caught it. Kid didn't straddle. And they're watching video at night, and there it is. And, you know, the race is scored. The race is in the books, you know? So it's like, you know, everybody's got good intentions, but mistakes happen.
Yeah. The other thing is I miss, talking about gatekeepers, I miss, hiking and having the gatekeepers point out like, hey, that's your gate. You know, that was always a fun experience, that little camaraderie of hiking for a gate, trying to remember which gate I missed and the gatekeeper is pointing it out to me. Obviously now that's, that they don't, you're not allowed to hike in slalom anymore.
Right.
So I'm trying to think of other things, that we can, talk. You know, another thing would be the team captains meeting. Most young ski racers hear about the mythical team captains meeting and have no idea what's going on. At a team captains meeting. So can you run me through, is it the chief of race who's running the team captains meeting?
It is typically, but let me back up. One thing I wanted to bring up is how a race is run, including, how they're scheduled, right? You know, like there's a massive schedule in the East. I think We have somewhere in the neighborhood of 160 or 180 FIS codexes that we need to manage, that each of those codexes need a TD. So in the summer, generally, we as organizers put in our sanction agreements, right? With US Ski and Snowboard, we put our agreements in, and they put them with the FIS, and the NGB gets them on the FIS calendar, as you guys see when you look at the FIS calendar. An enormous amount of work goes into that with Jeff Wyman and Margo in Park City. And especially as things change, it's crazy to keep up with in the East. The last few years have been really tough. I mean, January, I don't know how many changes there were to the calendar. In late March, things change, right? When the weather starts to be challenging. Jill Firstbrook and Paul Van Slyke are also super instrumental in making sure each of those race codexes has a qualified or, you know, a TD that can make it there that day. And sometimes in the East, we might have like five different series going on at once. So there's a lot of work behind the scenes to make all that happen.
Can I pause you right there?
Yeah,
when you say FIS codex, I want to explain that to people. Is it basically like white, for instance, Whiteface would apply to have a certain number of races on their schedule, and they'd say, these are the dates we're going to run races? Or how does getting a FIS codex work?
That's a good question. I think in the East, I'll speak to that. I mean, generally, the regional staff in what was previously Sam Damon and Paige Roberts, and now it's Marty Geyer, the calendars developed through the summer with input from the coaches around the East and programs. Then traditionally, that calendar and draft, you know, someone like Sam would go out to the sites to find out, hey, can you host here? Can you host this? That's a little bit of a, you know, a different conversation, right? You know, the regional staff might be looking for a particular venue for a particular field, right? Like an NJR versus a FIS Eastern Cup might be, you know, you're looking for a little bit different terrain or whatever that is, but it's a little subjective. And, you know, the hosts obviously have, you know, conversations as well with the regional staff. But in the end, the calendar comes together. It's a little bit of give and take. Can you do races here? We'd love to do races there instead. And all of a sudden you have a spreadsheet with tons of green confirmed races.
Okay.
And that's when generally at the end of August, the sanction agreements go in and they start to get calendared with the FIS. And then that's when it becomes like, okay, now we got a calendar, now we got events. How are we gonna get the people there? And that's where Jill and Paul come in and being like, these are where all the TDs, they're saying, hey, there's a 4-day FIS series, January 4th through 7th at Whiteface. Can you do it? Can you? And then, no, I can't, but I can do this race. You know, they're talking to the TDs that are in the East. So it's a massive group of people.
Gotcha. So I didn't realize that. So the head of the Eastern region, with input from coaches, will say, okay, we're going to do this many NJRs, national junior races, this many Devo races, this many FIS races, this many like Eastern Cups. And then once they have all of that set, they'll go out to the different clubs and say, can you do these races?
That's generally how it works. It's not, I would say that works for 75% of it. And then there might be times where sometimes it's driven by snow. Sometimes it's driven by whether you have a Super G venue or not. Sometimes it's driven on whether you're going to be race ready December 8th, which there's not very many people in the East that can be race. So a lot of times we're in Sunday River, right? Or Sugarloaf and up there early season. But that's it in a nutshell. Yeah.
Gotcha. Okay.
So then you have your race codex, then you got your TD assigned, and then you're coming up into the season, you know,
trying
weeks
to organize.
Before you're prepping the snow. I think this is where the chief of course's role starts to come into play, importantly, right? Here, no venue has a perfect surface all the time. It's just impossible, right? Like we're in an outdoor sport. There's so many different variables, but I guess I choose to look at it as we're trying to maintain a surface all the time. It's tough to just wake up on Friday morning and say, hey, we got a race tomorrow. Let's go make the snow hard. Without, you know, watering the hill and Mother Nature's help, you know, so you sort of have to make judgment calls. You got to work with your mountains to get the snow prepped as best you can. You got to work with the mountains to, you know, help you install BNet or deliver BNet. And then you got to put all that stuff in. Your chief of timing is up there testing wires, right? Earlier I said that's hardwired. So on the side of every race trail, almost, there are, you know, a massive wire that goes from top to bottom with junction boxes where, you know, there's somebody's checking that. And I'm actually going up later today to test all of our timing wire. Okay. Some of it was spliced, and I want to make sure every junction box along the top on the hill has good connectivity. So, you know, it's an ongoing thing. But there's a massive amount of work that goes into being ready before the night, before that team captain's meeting. And that's where I wanted to bring back into what you had asked, the team captain's meeting, right? Yeah. So the TD generally comes 2 days before, the day before, depending on whether it's a speed or tech event. So the TD does come early. They inspect with the chief of race generally. Mm-hmm. This is the safety installations. This is where we're going to start. This is where this is. And, you know, they discuss concerns they may see. They discuss the surface. Mm-hmm. They check in on the elevations. You know,
and the start, TD is basically saying, trying to, like, the TD's job is to say this is up to spec, basically.
Yeah, making sure that everything's within the rules.
The rules are being followed.
Some TDs, some organizers are really experienced, and other organizers don't. They might run a race, you know, especially at the children's level, they might run one, two races a year. So, you know, as a TD, you're walking in and you want to have the right amount of influence or input, right? If you have a good, trustworthy jury and a race organizer that does it all the time, you know, you're there to support. But at some place that doesn't do it a lot, you might have to be a little bit more active in helping them learn how to run races and do a little bit better job, you know, and making sure things are up. So, you know, enter the team captain's meeting, hopefully by 6 p.m. the night before the race. The start list, or I guess rather the list of competitors, is created. We have a good accurate number of who's gonna be there the next morning. Sometimes lists get wonky and we have a lot of pulls or a lot of ads or whatever. But generally speaking, you know, hopefully those entries are ready to go. The RA's got it. For those that have never been to a team captain's meeting, every athlete at a FIS race needs to be represented by a coach or by someone. So what does that mean? There's a roll call for every athlete on the board. And the coach says, you know, Smith, yes. You know, there'll be a roll call as somebody's calling the board, and each coach that's representing an athlete does. And if that coach isn't there, that athlete can't race the next morning. And then they go over the schedule, the weather, and any other particulars that might happen. At the end of the meeting, the board's closed and you should have a start list.
This Christmas, unwrap the gift of action, adventure, history, culture, nature, and wonder with official hospitality at the Olympic Winter Games. Enjoy premium tickets to sought-after events, including the opening ceremony, access to lounges, and world-class service. Or turn your stay into the trip of a lifetime with overnight packages that include tickets, guaranteed accommodation, and more, so you can immerse yourself in the wonder of Italy. Book now at hospitality.milanocortino2026.org. I know more about the captain's meetings now because racing independent, when I'm racing in the US, a lot of times I don't have a coach, so I need someone to rep me. I've made that mistake before where someone's texting me like, are you racing? I can rep you. The captain meeting has happened right now.
I've been at races and we've hosted team captain's meetings when it's you know, is that person racing? Anybody know? Oh, I'll text the coach, and the coach is out of service somewhere. They thought they'd be further along, and you know,
because the team captain's meeting is over Zoom these days now, right?
Now it's more often than not at Zoom. For years and years and years, it was scrambling to get to the coach's meeting, and it was actually a pretty fun, I don't know, a fun time for coaches to get together and, you know, sort of share, you know, stories and, I guess, camaraderie a little bit. And, you know, that doesn't happen as organically now that we use Zoom so much. But I will say the Zoom has allowed athletes to stay in school or get extra training on the day of the race when they normally would have had to leave at noon that day. There are some benefits to the Zoom piece, and there's some cost as everything as we move through life. Yeah. You know what I mean?
So. Yeah, definitely. That's fun to think about, though, is like getting all the coaches in a room for the captain's meeting. Yeah.
It used
And
to
the
be
chief.
in the old days. Well, in old days for me, and I'm not that old. I'm sure it happened differently years ago, but there was literally a physical board with a little
Like little slats, huh?
assigning little slots where you'd put a little piece of paper with the card and the USSA number and the seed points, and we'd physically move each athlete where they're going to start. And that was, that's what we did that for years, right? And really, COVID drove us to the Zoom piece more than anything.
And now it's just a computer, and you just have like a list, like on a PDF or an Excel or whatever. That's
Yeah,
it.
the rules state that the entire board should be visible. We do it in a Google spreadsheet or a Microsoft Excel spreadsheet with a screen share. So we'll do that draw where you can see everyone's name, and we'll call the board that way, and then we'll do the draw based on a randomization in Microsoft Excel. So the coaches and whoever's at the team captain's meeting can actually see it be drawn. So people are comfortable with how it's been done, and that's when I when and for those that don't know, most people know, but the top 15 typically in a fist race is drawn randomly, right? Everybody's seeded by their points. Top 15 are draw. In a Continental Cup, there might be other rules.
Yeah, it's in Continental
Series
Cup,
one.
it's the same as World Cup, which is the top seven based on like cumulative point rankings
Got it.
are random. 8 to 15 are random, and then 16 to 30 are based off of just points in that order.
Right, right. So that's what we call the draw. And
But so did that used to be like picking golf balls out of a bag or something like that?
you got it, right? So in a traditional way, and it still happens, but the ref or the chief of race or a couple people in the room would have two hats, right? With filled with golf balls labeled 1 to 15. And the first ball that was What was picked? It's called a double draw. The first ball that's picked is the racer, right? So there's 1 through 15 ranked. The fastest person in the race, technically by their points, right, is the lowest point holder, the bib one. So someone would say, racer number one. And then the other hat's over here at the other side of the room. Somebody's picking that ball out, and that says runs 15, right? And then that person would shout out runs 15. Somebody'd be at the board. They'd move that racer one down to 15. It was a sort of a fun ritual, but I miss parts of it, but the Zoom thing is also pretty slick too, so I don't
Yeah, definitely. And have you had any, now that we're kind of nearing the end of this interview, have you had any kind of crazy races that have happened or fun races or anything you can think of in
yeah
terms
I
of
think
running a race?
I think a couple. When I start to think about races, and I think there are times, I've learned with through blood and tears, right, that you can't control everything. The weather is going to do what it does, so that you can prep and get everything as ready as perfect as possible. Then it snows, I don't know, 4 inches of slop the next morning, and especially I find where the where that when that temperature is like right at freezing, it could go, if it's 2 inches warmer, it does this. If it's 2 inches colder, it does that. And some days it just wasn't meant to be, and that's all you can do. It also changes overnight, with the weather as it gets colder. I can think of one time that I think of fondly. We were leading up to the World University Games, which we hosted in 2023 in January. And a veteran coach who many of went up early, checked things out, and he was sliding on his coaching skis. And he said, he called me from cell phone. I was still on my way up, and he's like, "John, you got to groom. You got to do something." I'm like, "What do you mean? It must be perfect." And he's like, "I have never skied on anything this slick." He was holding the V-net trying to slide down the side of the hill, and fearing for his life, and of course we want a good, hard, firm, fair surface, but we don't want something that's slick. And that's a fine balance, right? Because there's plenty of days when the ski racers feel that it's a great event or a great surface and everybody's coming down, this is awesome. But you guys got to remember, I'm responsible for getting volunteers into place for gatekeeping or ski patrol down, right, to rescue an athlete. And if they're not comfortable getting to those places, it can be pretty pretty stressful. So it's a real balancing act. But anyway, this coach was clinging to the B net, trying to save his life. Anyway, it ended up being fine. It warmed up. But what had happened that night, that it had this like sort of rimy ice that formed, and it was so slick that it was like almost unedgeable. Of course, the next day, you know, it had warmed up a little bit and then froze again, and it changes. You know, the surface is constantly changing, so all you can do is try to manage it and have a good surface all the time as we can. Similarly, at that World University Games, I can remember, you know, once you get TV into the mix, it becomes really interesting because they have some people that are they have some people that know ski racing and know how to get around a mountain, and then they have some people that have no idea what ski racing is, but they're good at putting up scaffolding, or they're good at carrying cameras, or they're good at their camera people. And you know, one day I'm coming down and approaching the start, and here are these guys in like Carhartts and just messy overalls walking down the trail. And I'm like, oh my God, what are these guys doing here? They're like, excuse me, sir, do you need help? They're like, oh no, we're working the race. And they're from like, I don't even know where they're from, Boston or New York or something. And they're very hardworking professional, but they had no idea where they were headed and how steep it was where they were headed.
Yeah.
And so I get down there and I'm like, man, you cannot walk down this trail. I don't know if you understand that. You know, and they're like, oh no, it's fine. I've been there before, you know, and I'm like, okay. And here they come, and they're like, whoa. One guy's on a snowboard, the other guy's in walking boots, and I'm like, and boom, there goes the guy in the walking boots sliding down the hill. I'm like, oh no, what's gonna happen? So little things like that, you know, that's not little things, but it's like there's so many different variables pulling off a race, especially as you get into some of the bigger stuff for TV. It's unbelievable, but generally we make it work, and everybody, you know, works together to make it work.
Definitely.
And the other things there's other things you can't control, like mechanical failures, right? Like I can remember driving into the mountain and looking up, and there's the race trail with two cats on the race trail, and I'm like, this ought to be interesting. Morning, so I call the driver, you know, and usually when you're trying to prep a race trail, you groom early and you let it sit and set up and everything's good. But there's the cat. I'm like, oh my God, what happened? So I call the driver and he's like, well, the track, you know, the track came off the machine, and we had to call the mechanic in at 4 a.m. to come help get it off the hill. And, you know, and then I'm, you know, people or coaches are coming in like, what's going on? What's going on? You know, and, you know, some things you just can't control, you know, no matter how hard you try. But
definitely,
it's a great, I certainly enjoy hosting races. There's a sense of accomplishment after it comes off at the end of the day, and you know, certainly a sense of failure and a bummer when it doesn't, but you know, when you go to work and everybody works together for a common goal and making a fair race, it's, and kids walk away, you know, feeling good about it at the end. Not everybody, you know, the people that didn't have a fast time probably don't feel as good as the guys who won, or girls, but you know, that's why we do it, you know, and it's pretty rewarding when it all comes together.
Yeah. I was going to say, like, it must feel rewarding. I mean, it's a lot of work and a lot of long hours and a lot of dealing with the cold and the snow and the rain.
Yeah, absolutely.
But you get a lot of, it feels good to put off a good race, huh?
It does. It does. Especially at the end of a long series that, you know, when it feels like everything's against you, you know, it's 60 degrees and rain or it's 30 below and blowing hard, and you know, but then something changes and it all works, or the snow is getting prepped and you're down to the deadline, you're like, we got a race, and whatever it is, you know.
It is pretty miraculous considering all of the crazy weather we experience in the mountains.
Yeah.
I mean, the mountains have some of the worst weather in the world, especially the East Coast mountains.
Yeah, sure.
It is impressive that races get off. The last thing I wanted to say before we go is, and you can speak to this, it also requires, every race that happens requires consent and help from the resort. And what are things And a lot of resorts these days, especially like those owned by, you know, like Epic isn't super, or whatever, Vail Resorts isn't super excited about ski racing as maybe small resorts used to be. What are some things that athletes can do to make sure that their impact on the mountain is more positive than negative, and that That's resorts want to have like athletes back?
That's a great question, Jimmy. And I think, you know, and I think it comes in ebbs and flows from resorts and bigger companies supporting events or not supporting events. And I will tell you here, and I think it's true other places, because I talk to other organizers, you know, how the athletes act and their interaction with the other guests is crucial. It starts when they come into the parking lot, where the coach is parking, and whether they're working with playing nice with the parking attendants, and it goes all the way to the end of the day when the athletes are packing their bags and walking out of the lodge, and there's a pile of trash or food or whatever that's in the lodge. You know, we as a community need to make sure and do everything we can to promote our sport by being professional, courteous, and thankful for everybody that's doing this for us. Yeah, it's expensive, and we pay, you know, we pay a fee and all that. I don't want to discount that, but you know, everybody's doing that, and it becomes increasingly easy for a mountain manager to be like, hey, I can sell this full price ticket to somebody who is courteous or whatever, and these ski racers are, oh, they're making a mess in the lodge. It's not necessarily the hill space. Sometimes it's the hill space and closing trails and stuff like that, but I find more often than not, it's how they're treating other people in the paying public, we call them, right? You know, whether they clean up after themselves in the lodge, are they using the ski racks and managing their skis? How many times have I skied by the base quad here and the kids have their skis all lined up? I know why they do it. It's easy. It keeps the skis on the snow, and you know, it's a time saver, but there are people out there that don't know how to ski and they're trying to have a good experience and in the slow zones. Right. And we're ripping by, they're intimidated by us. Right. And if they get complaints and that, you know, so we need to be super courteous on and off the hill, pick up our skis, clean up after ourselves, go out of your way to say the thank yous to the parking attendants, the lift attendants, the janitorial staff, whoever you see. And I think that goes a long way, because the opposite is worse. You know, there's more to lose there than to gain, right? Yeah. There's more to lose when we have all the negatives, because when I go into the office and say, hey, I want to hold this race this day, or can we close this trail for training, or, you know, I want to have this group back over President's Week, you know, or sometime when we know it's going to be busy, they're like, well, no way. That group did this last year. They reported this, their skis, that they do this, whatever. So we all need to know, and if anybody's listening out there right now, be courteous, be professional, thank people as you're on the hill or in the lodge. It goes longer than you would ever care to admit or know.
That's a great thought to end on. Thank you, John, for joining me on Arc City. This episode, I thought that it was going to be about 25 minutes. I thought we were going to blast through all the officials, and this just goes to show how much goes into running a race. So thanks for walking me through it all. Thanks for being
on. Well, no problem. I appreciate being on, and thank you for having me.
I texted a bit with John after the interview, and he was worried that he hadn't accurately described the timing systems, and he clarified a few things. So first, almost all modern timing systems record times to the 10,000th of a second, but FIS rules require that the time be truncated to the 100th of a second for the official results. Truncation like means you simply chop off the last two digits. You don't round up or down. What's crazy/cool is that if you beat someone by 100th of a second on the official result sheet, your time in the timing system could have been, for example, 50.0100, and their time was 50.0099, and you actually only beat them by a 10,000th of a second. And then also, in reality, the mechanism of a start wand, the physical mechanism, especially when you compare it to the photocells at the finish, it's not precise enough to create data to the 10,000th of a second. So that's partially why they truncate the times. Well, that will bring us to the end. I just want to say I really appreciate you all listening. I'm currently competing on the European Cup and NORAM Cup circuits, and hopefully some more World Cup starts again this year. All of that keeps me pretty busy and kind of discourages me from putting aside time to also do the podcast. But when I hear from you guys that you like listening and that you listen, it motivates me to keep making the podcast happen. I really love this sport and I want to add to it, and that's why I do the podcast. Anyways, that's enough mushiness from me for now. Until next time, don't forget to buckle your boots, tighten your power straps, and never lose a race by a 10,000th of a second. And thank the people that make your races happen. I'm Jimmy Krupka, and thank you for visiting Arc City.